Okay, now to other things that are important because they are big changes that have taken place in the news this week. And I wanted to delve a little deeper into the changes now that mean that if you are accused of a rape or a sexual crime here in Queensland and you're charged, you can now be named before you're committed to stand trial. Now, you would have seen in the last couple of days and all over the news identity of high-profile cases that are waiting to go before the courts. And they include now the name of the Gold Coast childcare worker who's been charged with those horrific 1,600-plus offences stemming from alleged abuse of 91 little girls over 15 years. We now know he is Ashley Paul Griffith, and we've seen his face all over the news and newspapers. There are two other high-profile cases that remain secret, and temporary suppression orders have been granted for a high-profile Toowoomba man charged with two counts of rape and a Channel 7, what they're calling personality, charged with alleged crimes that span over a decade. And they include multiple allegations of indecent treatment of children under the age of 16, rape, sexual assault, torture and assault. Now, Calvin Ganek has been on the program with me several times. He's a lawyer and he's the managing director of Ganek and Associates. But Calvin's also a former police officer. So who better to answer some of the questions that still remain unanswered from the change to these laws? Good afternoon and welcome back once again, Calvin.
Hello, Sophie. How are you?
Very well, thank you. I really wanted to get a better understanding from you of how we're now going to see these changes implemented, Calvin, because, you know, we're not Robinson Crusoe here. We're now following in the footsteps of all the other states and territories who've already had these changes take place and where they've worked over time. Any change always comes with it some sort of, you know, the bubbles of it being sort of sorted out in real time. And I guess my first question to you is, and with your experience as a police officer, will it change the way charging happens, knowing now that people will be named as soon as a charge is brought against them by police?
Listen, I'm not sure whether it will change the way that charges are laid. There is a theory that will give a victim more comfort that the system is supportive of them rather than protecting the defendant. So from a psychological point of view, I'm not an expert in that space, but there is a theory that gives the victim more comfort to come forward, and there may very well be some merit to that. But as to whether it actually formulates a change in attitude towards charging, I'm not so sure.
There was one charge in particular that I think a lot of people have some, I don't know if it's so much confusion or certainly the one that I think would create the most amount of angst, and that is the charge of intent to commit rape. How much evidence would police need to charge someone if it is the intent but never actually happened, especially now knowing that someone's name could be in the public eye? Would you imagine that prosecutors would want to see more evidence to lay that sort of a charge?
Possibly. I think I've spoken on the show with you, Sophie, before about the evidentiary issues or hurdles that exist for offences that have intent attached to them, because it's a state of mind and it's very difficult, firstly, for police to gather evidence to support that element of the offence. And then it's equally as difficult for prosecutors to present evidence to convince a jury beyond reasonable doubt of that element. So it's always going to be difficult. We hope prosecutors and police continue to be responsible in the way that they wield that power of laying charges. But again, I don't know whether this particular law is going to change attitudes of police officers or prosecutors just because defendants are now being named. I think it's a more therapeutic position, that there's an advantage for victims to understand that the defendants are now not being protected separately from any other offence. Of course, all the commentary and the reasoning in the Women's Safety Justice Task Force recommendations was around victims being treated the same as other offences.
And I think from that perspective, there are two areas that I've had the most feedback from my 4BC listeners that I wanted to ask you about. And one is from the perspective of the victim. And you know, as you said, the task force and the way that this has come forward was to give that support and to be able to make sure that the victims are heard. And obviously, we also understand that if someone has been charged and is named, if there has been other people who have been victims, they are more likely to come forward
Yes, that's exactly right. And not just for sex offences, but the principle of open justice, and that's where this all stems from.
Yep.
Principle of open justice. I've been in many cases, not necessarily even sex-related offences, where the open justice, the reporting by the media, has caused a witness or some other valuable piece of evidence that no one knew about, including the police, knew about until it was reported through the media. So there is certainly that aspect of it as well.
The other question that obviously comes up an awful lot, and I'd love to get your feedback on, is what happens if someone finds themselves being named and then for whatever reason the charges are dropped? There are many people who want to know what happens if someone is falsely accused. You know, is there an avenue for compensation? Will it work like any other case in Queensland where an alleged offender can be named straight away?
Yeah, so that's the other side of the coin, and that is that there's a particular atmosphere around allegations of sexual offences, and for good reason, a stigma that's attached to charges even being laid. And in this time, this day and age, with social media and the way that everything's reported, it's obviously more prevalent than it was 30, 40, 50 years ago when it was just the newspaper and that's it. So it is very difficult to get compensation after winning a trial when you've been charged and found not guilty. And I guess it's left with the media for balanced reporting, that if they report that a person has been charged, that the same balanced reporting if that charge is discontinued or unsuccessful.
And when we talk about these two high-profile cases, and there no doubt will be others where there are temporary suppression orders in place, how important is that that happens, not just for the non-publication order, but if you find that there ends up being a jury trial and you don't want to be prejudicing a jury, is that kind of muddied waters?
Yeah, so we certainly don't want in any avenue a system that compromises the justice system. So here it's perfectly proper that there's an exception. And what isn't being reported enough, I think, is that there is a legislative exception that exists before even a non-publication order is made. And it's still the case that you can't report on any facts which reveal the name, address, school, place of employment, or any other particular that's likely to lead to the identification of the complainant. So it is the case the complainant remains specifically protected. But because of that restriction, there will be cases where the name of the person cannot be reported, just simply because by naming the person, it'll immediately identify who the complainant is.
Right.
If it is a lineal descendant, if it's a child or a sibling, et cetera, et cetera. So there is that automatic protection that, although it's focused upon protecting the complainant, it will affect the ability to report on the identity of the defendant. But getting back to your question, Sophie, it's really important, and the grounds are very narrow. So there's certainly not going to be a floodgates sort of argument here where there'll be numerous orders. They will be rare in my opinion, but the legislation specifically says that a non-publication order can be made when the court considers it's necessary to prevent the prejudice to the proper administration of justice in order to prevent undue hardship or distress to the complainant or a witness, and to protect the safety of any person. So it's very narrow, but it's important that that exception is there as well. The other aspect of it that I thought was quite important is that from a media point of view, that if anyone makes any lawyer makes an application on behalf of their defendant, there's an obligation that the media organisations also be served with the application.
Right.
So the applications can't be done in secret. The media organisations have to be served, and they'll have the opportunity to appear before the court and argue against those orders being made.
One other case that I really wanted to have your feedback on this afternoon, and it happened in Sydney, but we have learnt more about bail and bail conditions, I think, over the last few years more broadly in the general public than I think any of us ever thought we would. And obviously I'm speaking more specifically about what's gone on when it comes to youth justice in Queensland. This is a slightly different case, but I think one that does still go to the understanding of when and how bail is granted. And I'm talking about the case of the man who's allegedly murdered his mother in Sydney. He appeared again before court today. He's a 31-year-old, Troy Safranco, charged now with murdering his mum at their Bankstown home on Sunday. His mother, a 67-year-old, was found in the backyard. She suffered catastrophic injuries. And we learnt very quickly that he had been charged with choking his mother on the Friday, went before the courts and was granted bail on the Saturday. And then Sunday night, his mum's dead, and so was the dog, and the house was destroyed by fire. And now he's faced court again today. What do we learn from this about bail and bail conditions? And, you know, that obviously the judiciary, like everything else, don't always get it right. But do we need to be putting more scrutiny on bail conditions?
Sophie, when cases like this happen, the answer to that question is a clearly yes. But it's a complicated system. You're basically putting a magistrate or a judge in the position of being able to predict the future. At the same time, they're trying to balance very valued principles such as the presumption of innocence. And we've seen in Queensland here, there's a resourcing issue at the moment. And that is that you can't just keep locking people up because there's no room to put them in there. There's no room to house them. So when you look in isolation at this very sad case out of Bankstown in Sydney, yes, of course, the answer to that is an overwhelming yes, but there are other complicating factors that exist. The bail laws here in Queensland just keep getting tinkered with and have been made stronger and stronger over the years. But I don't think it matters how strong we make the bail laws. There's always got to be an element of human judgment in whether someone is released on bail or not, and that's not a perfect system.
No, clearly not. Neither is the concept of an AVO, clearly.
Yes, that's right.
You know, and I think time and time again, I don't know what the answer is, but I don't think, you know, an AVO, what do we do that's different, Calvin? Like, you know, you tell somebody that they can't do something and they go and do it anyway. And like you said, where do you put them? In this case, a woman's now dead.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, those decisions about making a domestic violence order, they are just conditions that require compliance. If someone's willing to not comply to it, it doesn't matter how many resources the police have to police those orders. Unfortunately, they are going to happen. I think I've said on the station with you as well, Sophie, when it comes to youth justice and domestic violence, there is really no answer that anyone's yet discovered around the world to resolve that issue. We just have to keep moving in the right direction, which I think we are.
Finally, Calvin, before I let you go, I know you're well aware of, you know, the steps that are now being made, pushed, we could say, by the Voice for Victims and Ben Cannon, and, you know, what we are now seeing as the first steps of hopefully some meaningful change when it comes to the issues of youth crime and youth justice. What are you hearing while you're going about your work with Gannett and Associates? Are these welcome changes? Are they likely to be something that is going to not only have the change that everyone is pushing for in the community, but have some real change when and if these kids actually find themselves committing crimes and being put before the courts?
Again, you give me all the very difficult questions, Sophie. listen, youth justice is, again, a really complicated issue. I come back to it, I really think it's a social issue, not a legal issue, and that is that once young people are no longer respecting parents, teachers, authority in any way, it doesn't matter what systems are put in place. So we've really got to get right down to the bottom cause of why these youths are getting into this position. And it's usually the issue, in my experience, both as a police officer and a lawyer, the issue normally starts well before police even have contact with the child.
Yeah, we've got to go right back to the source, don't we? Right back to the beginning, and probably a little bit more attention and resources put on that, Calvin, as uncomfortable as it is. And while you were giving me that answer, Ash, who's here in the studio with me, is giving a nodding head. I think there are many people who agree. You put that very well and succinctly. So one step at a time, hopefully in the right direction. As always, a pleasure to have you on the program. Really appreciate your time this afternoon.